city of Paris on September the 3rd, 1783. Some people like George Washington believed the United States existed, while other people like King George III vehemently rejected this idea. Disagreements about the existence of states cannot be resolved by an objective test, such as a DNA survey or a sonar scan. Unlike animals, states are not an objective reality. When we ask whether a particular state exists, we are raising a question about intersubjective reality. If enough people agree that a particular state exists, then it does. It can then do things like sign legally binding treaties with other governments, as well as NGOs and private corporations. Of all genres of stories, those that create intersubjective realities have been the most crucial for the development of large-scale human networks. Implanting fake family memories is certainly helpful, but no religions or empires managed to survive for long without a strong belief in the existence of a god, a nation, a law code, or a currency. For the formation of the Christian Church, for example, it was important that people recollect what Jesus said at the Last Supper. But the crucial step was making people believe that Jesus was a god rather than just an inspiring rabbi. For the formation of the Jewish religion, it was helpful that Jews remembered how they together escaped slavery in Egypt. But the really decisive step was making all Jews adhere to the same religious law code, the Halakha. Intersubjective things like laws, gods, and currencies are extremely powerful within a particular information network and utterly meaningless outside it. Suppose a billionaire crashes his private jet on the desert island and finds himself alone with a suitcase full of banknotes and bonds. When he was in Sao Paulo or Mumbai, he could use these papers to make people feed him, clothe him, protect him, and build him a private jet. But once he is cut off from other members of our information network, his banknotes and bonds immediately become worthless. He cannot use them to get the island's monkeys to provide him with food, or to build him a raft. The power of stories. Whether through implanting fake memories, forming fictional relationships, or creating intersubjective realities, stories produced large-scale human networks. These networks, in turn, completely changed the balance of power in the world. Story-based networks made Homo sapiens the most powerful of all animals, giving it a crucial edge not only over lions and mammoths, but also over other ancient human species like Neanderthals. Neanderthals lived in small, isolated bands, and to the best of our knowledge, different bands cooperated with one another only rarely and weakly, if at all. Stone Age sapiens, too, lived in small bands of a few dozen individuals. But following the emergence of storytelling, sapiens bands no longer lived in isolation. Bands were connected by stories about things like revered ancestors, totem animals, and guardian spirits. Bands that shared stories and intersubjective realities constituted a tribe. Each tribe was a network connecting hundreds or even thousands of individuals. Belonging to a large tribe had an obvious advantage in times of conflict. 500 sapiens could easily defeat 50 Neanderthals. But tribal networks had many additional advantages. If we live in an isolated band of 50 people and a severe drought hits our home territory, many of us might starve to death. If we try to migrate elsewhere, we are likely to encounter hostile groups, and we might also find it difficult to forage for food, water, and flint to make tools in unfamiliar territory. However, if our band is part of a tribal network, in times of need, at least some of us could go live with our distant friends. If our shared tribal identity is strong enough, they would welcome us and teach us about the local dangers and opportunities. A decade or two later, we might reciprocate. The tribal network then acted like an insurance policy. It minimized risk by spreading it across a lot more people. Even in quiet times, sapients could benefit enormously from exchanging information, not just with a few dozen members of a small band, but with an entire tribal network. If one of the tribe's bands discovered a better way to make spear points, learned how to heal wounds with some rare medicinal herb, or invented a needle to sew clothes, that knowledge could be quickly passed to the other bands. Even though individually sapients might not have been more intelligent than Neanderthals, 500 sapients together were far more intelligent than 50 Neanderthals. All this was made possible by stories. The power of stories is often missed or denied by materialist interpretations of history. In particular, Marxists tend to view stories as merely a smokescreen for underlying power relations and material interests. According to Marxist theories, people are always motivated by objective material interests and use stories only to camouflage these interests and confound their rivals. For example, in this reading, the Crusades, World War I, and the Iraq War were all fought for the economic interests of powerful elites rather than for religious, nationalist, or liberal ideals. Understanding these wars means setting aside all the mythological fig leaves about God, patriotism, or democracy, and observing power relations in their nakedness. This Marxist view, however, is not only cynical, but wrong. While materialist interests certainly played a role in the Crusades, World War I, the Iraq War, and most other human conflicts, that does not mean that religious, national, and liberal ideals played no role at all. Moreover, materialist interests by themselves cannot explain the identities of the rival camps. Why is it that in the 12th century, landowners and merchants from France, Germany, and Italy united to conquer territories and trade routes in the Levant, instead of landowners and merchants from France and North Africa uniting to conquer Italy? And why is it that in 2003, the United States and Britain sought to conquer the oil fields of Iraq rather than the gas fields of Norway? Can this really be explained by purely materialist considerations, without any recourse to people's religious and ideological beliefs? In fact, all relations between large-scale human groups are shaped by stories, because the identities of these groups are themselves defined by stories. There are no objective definitions for who is British, American, Norwegian, or Iraqi. All these identities are shaped by national and religious myths that are constantly challenged and revised. Marxists may claim that large-scale groups have objective identities and interests independent of stories. If that is so, how can we explain that only humans have large-scale groups like tribes, nations, and religions, whereas chimpanzees lack them? After all, chimpanzees share with humans all our objective material interests. They too need to drink, eat, and protect themselves from diseases. They too want sex and social power. But chimpanzees cannot maintain large-scale groups because they are unable to create the stories that connect such groups and define their identities and interests. Contrary to Marxist thinking, large-scale identities and interests in history are always intersubjective. They are never objective. This is good news. If history had been shaped solely by material interests and power struggles, there would be no point talking to people who disagree with us. Any conflict would ultimately be the result of objective power relations, which cannot be changed merely by talking. In particular, if privileged people can see and believe only those things that enshrine their privileges, how can anything except violence persuade them to renounce those privileges and alter their beliefs? Luckily, since history is shaped by intersubjective stories, sometimes we can avert conflict and make peace by talking with people, changing the stories in which they and we believe, or coming up with a new story that everyone can accept. Take, for example, the rise of Nazism. There certainly were material interests that drove millions of Germans to support Hitler. The Nazis would probably never have come to power had it not been for the economic crisis of the early 1930s. However, it is wrong to think that the Third Reich was the inevitable outcome of underlying power relations and material interests. Hitler won the 1933 elections because during the economic crisis, millions of Germans came to believe the Nazi story rather than one of the alternative stories on offer. This wasn't the inevitable result of Germans pursuing their material interests and protecting their privileges. It was a tragic mistake. We can confidently say that it was a mistake, and that Germans could have chosen better stories because we know what happened next. 12 years of Nazi rule didn't foster the Germans' material interests. Nazism led to the destruction of Germany and the deaths of millions. Later, when Germans adopted liberal democracy, this did lead to a lasting improvement in their lives. Couldn't the Germans have skipped the failed Nazi experiment and put their faith in liberal democracy already in the early 1930s? The position of this book is that they could have. History is often shaped not by deterministic power relations, but rather by tragic mistakes that result from believing in mesmerizing, but harmful, stories. The Noble Lie. The centrality of stories reveals something fundamental about the power of our species, and it explains why power doesn't always go hand in hand with wisdom. The naive view of information says that information leads to truth, and knowing the truth helps people to gain both power and wisdom. This sounds reassuring. It implies that people who ignore the truth are unlikely to have much power, whereas people who respect the truth can gain much power, but that power would be tempered by wisdom. For example, people who ignore the truth about human biology might believe racist myths, but will not be able to produce powerful medicines and bioweapons, whereas people who understand biology will have that kind of power, but will not use it in the service of racist ideologies. If this had indeed been the case, we could sleep calmly, trusting our presidents, high priests, and CEOs to be wise and honest. A politician, a movement, or a country might conceivably get ahead here and there with the help of lies and deceptions, but in the long term, that would be a self-defeating strategy. Unfortunately, this is not the world in which we live. In history, power stems only partially from knowing the truth. It also stems from the ability to maintain social order among a large number of people. Suppose you want to make an atom bomb. To succeed, you obviously need some accurate knowledge of physics. But you also need lots of people to mine uranium ore, build nuclear reactors, and provide food for the construction workers, miners, and physicists. The Manhattan Project directly employed about 130,000 people, with millions more working to sustain them. Robert Oppenheimer could devote himself to his equations because he relied on thousands of miners to extract uranium at the El Dorado mine in northern Canada and the Shinkolobwe mine in the Belgian Congo, not to mention the farmers who grew potatoes for his lunch. If you want to make an atom bomb, you must find a way to make millions of people cooperate. It is the same with all ambitious projects that humans undertake. A Stone Age band going to hunt a mammoth obviously needed to know some facts about mammoths. If they believed they could kill a mammoth by casting spells, their hunting expedition would have failed. But knowing facts about mammoths wasn't enough. The hunters also needed to risk death and show great courage. If they believed that a certain spell guaranteed a good afterlife for dead hunters, their hunting expeditions had a much higher chance of success. Even if the spell did not benefit dead hunters in any way, By fortifying the courage and solidarity of living hunters, it made a crucial contribution to the hunt's success. If you build a bomb and ignore the facts of physics, the bomb will not explode. But if you build an ideology and ignore the facts, the ideology may still prove explosive. While power depends on both truth and order, it is usually the people who know how to build ideologies and maintain order who give instructions to the people who merely know how to build bombs or hunt mammoths. Robert Oppenheimer obeyed Franklin Delano Roosevelt rather than the other way around. Similarly, Werner Heisenberg obeyed Adolf Hitler, Igor Kurchatov deferred to Joseph Stalin, and in contemporary Iran, experts in nuclear physics follow the orders of experts in Shiite theology. What the people at the top know, which nuclear physicists don't always realize, is that telling the truth about the universe is hardly the most efficient way to produce order among large numbers of humans. It is true that E equals mc squared, and it explains a lot of what happens in the universe. But knowing that E equals mc squared usually doesn't resolve political disagreements or inspire people to make sacrifices for a common cause. Instead, what holds human networks together tends to be fictional stories, especially stories about intersubjective things like gods, money, and nations. When it comes to uniting people, fiction enjoys two inherent advantages over the truth. First, fiction can be made as simple as we like, whereas the truth tends to be complicated, because the reality it is supposed to represent is complicated. Take, for example, the truth about nations. It is difficult to grasp that the nation to which one belongs is an intersubjective entity that exists only in our collective imagination. You rarely hear politicians say such things in their political speeches. It is far easier to believe that our nation is God's chosen people, entrusted by the Creator with some special mission. This simple story has been repeatedly told by countless politicians from Israel to Iran and from the United States to Russia. Second, the truth is often painful and disturbing. And if we try to make it more comforting and flattering, it will no longer be the truth. In contrast, fiction is highly malleable. The history of every nation contains some dark episodes that citizens don't like to acknowledge and remember. An Israeli politician who in her election speeches details the miseries inflicted on Palestinian civilians by the Israeli occupation is unlikely to get many votes. In contrast, a politician who builds a national myth by ignoring uncomfortable facts, focusing on glorious moments in the Jewish past and embellishing reality wherever necessary, may well sweep to power. That's the case not just in Israel, but in all countries. How many Italians or Indians want to hear the unblemished truth about their nations? An uncompromising adherence to the truth is essential for scientific progress, and it is also an admirable spiritual practice, but it is not a winning political strategy. Already in his Republic, Plato imagined that the constitution of his utopian state would be based on the noble lie, a fictional story about the origin of the social order, one that secures the citizens' loyalty and prevents them from questioning the constitution. Citizens should be told, Plato wrote, that they were all born out of the earth, that the land is their mother, and that they therefore owe filial loyalty to the motherland. They should further be told that when they were conceived, the gods intermingled different metals, gold, silver, bronze, and iron, into them, which justifies a natural hierarchy between golden rulers and bronze servants. While Plato's utopia was never realized in practice, numerous polities through the ages told their inhabitants variations of this noble lie. Plato's noble lie notwithstanding, we should not conclude that all politicians are liars or that all national histories are deceptions. The choice isn't simply between telling the truth and lying. There is a third option. Telling a fictional story is lying only when you pretend that the story is a true representation of reality. Telling a fictional story isn't lying when you avoid such pretense and acknowledge that you are trying to create a new intersubjective reality rather than represent a pre-existing objective reality. For example, on September 17, 1787, the Constitutional Convention signed the US Constitution, which came into force in 1789. The Constitution didn't reveal any pre-existing truth about the world, but crucially, it wasn't a lie either. Rejecting Plato's recommendation, the authors of the text didn't deceive anyone about the text's origins. They didn't pretend that the text came down from heaven or that it had been inspired by some god. Rather, they acknowledged that it was an extremely creative legal fiction generated by fallible human beings. "We, the people of the United States," says the Constitution about its own origins, "in order to form a more perfect union, do ordain and establish this Constitution." Despite the acknowledgement that it is a human-made legal fiction, the US Constitution indeed managed to form a powerful union. It has maintained for more than two centuries a surprising degree of order among many millions of people who belong to a wide range of religious, ethnic, and cultural groups. The US Constitution has thus functioned like a tune that, without claiming to represent anything, has nevertheless made numerous people act together in order. It is crucial to note that order should not be confused with fairness or justice. The order created and maintained by the US Constitution condoned slavery, the subordination of women, the expropriation of indigenous people, and extreme economic inequality. The genius of the US Constitution is that by acknowledging that it is a legal fiction created by human beings, it was able to provide mechanisms to reach agreement on amending itself and remedying its own injustices, as Chapter 5 explores in greater depth. The Constitution's Article 5 details how people can propose and ratify such amendments, which shall be valid to all intents and purposes as part of this Constitution. Less than a century after the Constitution was written, the 13th Amendment abolished slavery. In this, the US Constitution was fundamentally different from stories that denied their fictive nature and claimed divine origin, such as the Ten Commandments. Like the US Constitution, the Ten Commandments endorsed slavery. The 10th Commandment says, "You shall not covet your neighbor's house, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or his male slave or female slave." Exodus 20:17. This implies that God is perfectly okay with people holding slaves and objects only to the coveting of slaves belonging to someone else. But unlike the US Constitution, the Ten Commandments failed to provide any amendment mechanism. There is no 11th commandment that says you can amend commandments by a two-thirds majority vote. This crucial difference between the two texts is clear from their opening gambits. The US Constitution opens with, "We the people." By acknowledging its human origin, it invests humans with the power to amend it. The Ten Commandments open with, "I am the Lord your God." By claiming divine origin, it precludes humans from changing it. As a result, the biblical text still endorses slavery even today. All human political systems are based on fictions, but some admit it and some do not. Being truthful about the origins of our social order makes it easier to make changes in it. If humans like us invented it, we can amend it. But such truthfulness comes at a price. Acknowledging the human origins of the social order makes it harder to persuade everyone to agree on it. If humans like us invented it, Why should we accept it? As we shall see in Chapter 5, until the late 18th century, the lack of mass communication technology made it extremely difficult to conduct open debates between millions of people about the rules of the social order. To maintain order, Russian Tsars, Muslim Caliphs, and Chinese Sons of Heaven therefore claimed that the fundamental rules of society came down from heaven and were not open to human amendment. In the early 21st century, many political systems still claim superhuman authority and oppose open debates that may result in unwelcome changes. The perennial dilemma. After we understand the key role of fiction in history, it is finally possible to present a more complete model of information networks, which goes beyond both the naive view of information and the populist critique of that view. Contrary to the naive view, information isn't the raw material of truth, and human information networks aren't geared only to discover the truth. But contrary to the populist view, information isn't just a weapon either. Rather, to survive and flourish, every human information network needs to do two things simultaneously: discover truth and create order. Accordingly, as history unfolded, human information networks have been developing two distinct sets of skills. On the one hand, as the naive view expects, the networks have learned how to process information to gain a more accurate understanding of things like medicine, mammoths, and nuclear physics. At the same time, the networks have also learned how to use information to maintain stronger social order among larger populations, by using not just truthful accounts, but also fictions, fantasies, propaganda, and, occasionally, downright lies. Having a lot of information doesn't in and of itself guarantee either truth or order. It is a difficult process to use information to discover the truth and simultaneously use it to maintain order. What makes things worse is that these two processes are often contradictory, because it is frequently easier to maintain order through fictions. Sometimes, as in the case of the US Constitution, fictional stories may acknowledge their fictionality, but more often they disavow it. Religions, for example, always claim to be an objective and eternal truth rather than a fictional story invented by humans. In such cases, the search for truth threatens the foundations of the social order. Many societies require their populations not to know their true origins. Ignorance is strength. What happens then when people get uncomfortably close to the truth? What happens when the same bit of information reveals an important fact about the world and also undermines the noble lie that holds society together? In such cases, society may seek to preserve order by placing limits on the search for truth. One obvious example is Darwin's theory of evolution. Understanding evolution greatly advances our understanding of the origins and biology of species, including Homo sapiens, but it also undermines the central myths that maintain order in numerous societies. No wonder that various governments and churches have banned or limited the teaching of evolution, preferring to sacrifice truth for the sake of order. A related problem is that an information network may allow and even encourage people to search for truth, but only in specific fields that help generate power without threatening the social order. The result can be a very powerful network that is singularly lacking in wisdom. Nazi Germany, for example, cultivated many of the world's leading experts in chemistry, optics, engineering, and rocket science. It was largely Nazi rocket science that later took the Americans to the moon. This scientific prowess helped the Nazis build an extremely powerful war machine, which was then deployed in the service of a deranged and murderous mythology. Under Nazi rule, Germans were encouraged to develop rocket science, but they were not free to question racist theories about biology and history. That's a major reason why the history of human information networks isn't a triumphant march of progress. While over the generations, human networks have grown increasingly powerful, they have not necessarily grown increasingly wise. If a network privileges order over truth, it can become very powerful but use that power unwisely. Instead of a march of progress, the history of human information networks is a tightrope walk, trying to balance truth with order. In the 21st century, we aren't much better at finding the right balance than our ancestors were in the Stone Age. Contrary to what the mission statements of corporations like Google and Facebook imply, simply increasing the speed and efficiency of our information technology doesn't necessarily make the world a better place. It only makes the need to balance truth and order more urgent. The invention of the story taught us this lesson already tens of thousands of years ago. And the same lesson would be taught again when humans came up with their second great information technology, the written document. Chapter 3. Documents. The Bite of the Paper Tigers. Stories were the first crucial information technology developed by humans. They laid the foundation for all large-scale human cooperation and made humans the most powerful animals on Earth. But as an information technology, stories have their limitations. To appreciate this, consider the role storytelling plays in the formation of nations. Many nations have first been conceived in the imagination of poets. Sarah Aronson and the Neely Underground are remembered by present-day Israelis as some of the first Zionists who risked their lives in the 1910s to establish a Jewish state in Palestine. But from where did Neely members get this idea in the first place? They were inspired by an earlier generation of poets, thinkers, and visionaries such as Theodor Herzl and Chaim Nachman Bialik. In the 1890s and first decade of the 20th century, Bialik, a Ukrainian Jew, published numerous poems and stories bewailing the persecution and weakness of European Jews and calling on them to take their fate in their hands, to defend themselves by force of arms, immigrate to Palestine, and there establish their own state. One of his most stirring poems was written following the Kishinev pogrom of 1903, in which 49 Jews were murdered and dozens more were injured. In the City of Slaughter, condemned the murderous anti-Semitic mob who perpetrated the atrocities, but it also criticized the Jews themselves for their pacifism and helplessness. In one heart-wrenching scene, Bialik describes how Jewish women were gang-raped while their husbands and brothers hid nearby, afraid to intervene. The poem compares the Jewish men to terrified mice and imagines how they quietly prayed to God to perform some miracle which failed to materialize. The poem then tells how even after the pogrom was over, the survivors had no thought of arming themselves, and instead entered Talmudic disputations about whether the raped women were now ritualistically defiled or whether they were still pure. This poem is mandatory reading in many Israeli schools today. It is also mandatory reading for anyone wishing to understand how after 2 millennia of being one of the most pacifist groups in history, Jews built one of the most formidable armies in the world. Not for nothing was Bialik named Israel's national poet. The fact that Bialik lived in Ukraine and was intimately familiar with the persecution of Ashkenazi Jews in Eastern Europe, but had little understanding of conditions in Palestine, contributed to the subsequent conflict there between Jews and Arabs. Bialik's poems inspired Jews to see themselves as victims in dire need of developing their military might and building their own country, but hardly considered the catastrophic consequences for the Arab inhabitants of Palestine, or indeed for the Mizrahi Jewish communities native to the Middle East. When the Arab-Israeli conflict exploded in the late 1940s, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians and hundreds of thousands of Mizrahi Jews were driven out of their ancestral homes in the Middle East, partly as a result of poems composed half a century earlier in Ukraine. While Bialik was writing in Ukraine, the Hungarian Jew, Theodor Herzl, was busy organizing the Zionist movement in the 1890s and early years of the 20th century. As a central part of his political activism, Herzl published two books. The Jewish State, 1896, was a manifesto outlining Herzl's idea of establishing a Jewish state in Palestine, and The Old New Land, 1902, was a utopian novel set in the year 1923, describing the prosperous Jewish state that Herzl envisioned. The two books, which fatefully also tended to ignore realities on the ground in Palestine, were immensely influential in shaping the Zionist movement. The Old New Land appeared in Hebrew under the title Tel Aviv, a loose Hebrew translation of Old New Land. The city of Tel Aviv, established 7 years after the book's publication, took its name from the book. While Bialik is Israel's national poet, Herzl is known as the visionary of the state. The yarns Bialik and Herzl wove ignored many crucial facts about contemporary reality, most notably that around 1900, the Jews of Palestine comprised only 6-9% of the region's total population of about 600,000 people. While disregarding such demographic facts, Bialik and Herzl accorded great importance to mythology, most notably the stories of the Bible, without which modern Zionism is unimaginable. Bialik and Herzl were also influenced by the nationalist myths that were created in the 19th century by almost every other ethnic group in Europe. The Ukrainian Jew Bialik and the Hungarian Jew Herzl did for Zionism what was earlier done by the poets Taras Shevchenko for Ukrainian nationalism, Sandor Petofi for Hungarian nationalism, and Adam Mickiewicz for Polish nationalism. Observing the growth of other national movements all around, Herzl wrote that nations arise out of dreams, songs, fantasies. But dreams, songs, and fantasies, however inspiring, are not enough to create a functioning nation-state. Bialik inspired generations of Jewish fighters, but to equip and maintain an army, it is also necessary to raise taxes and buy guns. Herzl's utopian book laid the foundations for the city of Tel Aviv, but to keep the city going, it was also necessary to dig a sewage system. When all is said and done, the essence of patriotism isn't reciting stirring poems about the beauty of the motherland, and it certainly isn't making hate-filled speeches against foreigners and minorities. Rather, patriotism means paying your taxes so that people on the other side of the country also enjoy the benefit of a sewage system, as well as security, education, and healthcare. To manage all these services and raise the necessary taxes, enormous amounts of information need to be collected, stored, and processed. Information about properties, payments, exemptions, discounts, debts, inventories, shipments, budgets, bills, and salaries. This, however, is not the kind of information that can be turned into a memorable poem or a captivating myth. Instead, tax records come in the shape of various types of lists, ranging from a simple item-by-item record to more elaborate tables and spreadsheets. No matter how intricate these data sets may become, they eschew narrative in favor of dryly listing amounts owed and amounts paid. Poets can afford to ignore such mundane facts, but tax collectors cannot. Lists are crucial not only for national taxation systems, but also for almost all other complex financial institutions. Corporations, banks, and stock markets cannot exist without them. A church, a university, or a library that wants to balance its budget soon realizes that in addition to priests and poets who can mesmerize people with stories, it needs accountants who know their way around the various types of lists. Lists and stories are complementary. National myths legitimize the tax records, while the tax records help transform aspirational stories into concrete schools and hospitals. Something analogous happens in the field of finance. The dollar, the pound sterling, and the Bitcoin are all brought into being by persuading people to believe a story. And tales told by bankers, finance ministers, and investment gurus raise or lower their value. When the chairperson of the Federal Reserve wants to curb inflation, when a finance minister wants to pass a new budget, and when a tech entrepreneur wants to draw investors, they all turn to storytelling. But to actually manage a bank, a budget, or a startup, lists are essential. The big problem with lists, and the crucial difference between lists and stories, is that lists tend to be far more boring than stories, which means that while we easily remember stories, we find it difficult to remember lists. This is an important fact about how the human brain processes information. Evolution has adapted our brains to be good at absorbing, retaining, and processing even very large quantities of information when they are shaped into a story. The Ramayana, one of the foundational tales of Hindu mythology, is 24,000 verses long and runs to about 1,700 pages in modern editions. Yet despite its enormous length, generations of Hindus succeeded in remembering and reciting it by heart. In the 20th and 21st centuries, the Ramayana was repeatedly adapted for film and television. In 1987-88, a 78-episode version, running to about 2,730 minutes, was the most watched television series in the world, with more than 650 million viewers. According to a BBC report, when episodes were aired, streets would be deserted, shops would be closed, and people would bathe and garland their TV sets. During the 2020 COVID-19 lockdown, the series was re-aired and again became the most watched show in the world. While modern TV audiences need not memorize any texts by heart, it is noteworthy how easy they find it to follow the intricate plots of epic dramas, detective thrillers, and soap operas, recalling who each character is and how they are related to numerous others. We are so accustomed to performing such feats of memory that we seldom consider how extraordinary they are. What makes us so good at remembering epic poems and long-running TV series is that long-term human memory is particularly adapted to retaining stories. As Kendall Haven writes in his 2007 book, Story Proof, The Science Behind the Startling Power of Story, human minds rely on stories and on story architecture as the primary roadmap for understanding, making sense of, remembering, and planning our lives. Lives are like stories because we think in story terms. Haven references more than 120 academic studies, concluding that research overwhelmingly, convincingly, and without opposition provides the evidence that stories are a highly efficient vehicle for communicating factual, conceptual, emotional, and tacit information. In contrast, most people find it hard to remember lists by heart, and few people would be interested in watching a TV recitation of India's tax records or annual budget. Mnemonic methods used to memorize lists of items often work by weaving the items into a plot, thereby turning the list into a story. But even with the help of such mnemonic devices, who could remember their country's tax records or budget? The information may be vital, determining what quality of healthcare, education, and welfare services citizens enjoy, but our brains are not adapted to remembering such things. Unlike national poems and myths, which can be stored in our brains, complex national taxation and administration systems have required a unique, non-organic information technology in order to function. This technology is the written document. To kill alone. The written document was invented many times in many places. Some of the earliest examples come from ancient Mesopotamia. A cuneiform clay tablet dated to the 28th day of the 10th month of the 41st year of the reign of King Shulgi of Ur, circa 2053-54 BCE, recorded the monthly deliveries of sheep and goats. 15 sheep were delivered on the second day of the month, 7 sheep on the third day, 11 sheep on the fourth, 219 on the fifth, 47 on the sixth, and so on until 3 sheep were delivered on the 28th. In total, says the clay tablet, 896 animals were received that month. Remembering all these deliveries was important for the royal administration, to monitor people's obedience and to keep track of available resources. While doing so in one's head was a formidable challenge, it was easy for a learned scribe to write them down on a clay tablet. Like stories and like all other information technologies in history, written documents didn't necessarily represent reality accurately. The Ur tablet, for example, contained a mistake. The document says that 896 animals were received during that month. But when modern scholars added up all the individual entries, they reached a total of 898. The scribe who wrote the document apparently made a mistake when he calculated the overall tally, and the tablet preserved this mistake for posterity. But whether true or false, written documents created new realities. By recording lists of properties, taxes, and payments, they made it far easier to create administrative systems, kingdoms, religious organizations, and trade networks. More specifically, documents changed the method used for creating intersubjective realities. In oral cultures, intersubjective realities were created by telling a story that many people repeated with their mouths and remembered in their brains. Brain capacity consequently placed a limit on the kinds of intersubjective realities that humans created. Humans couldn't forge an intersubjective reality that their brains couldn't remember. This limit could be transcended, however, by writing documents. The documents didn't represent an objective empirical reality. The reality was the documents themselves. As we shall see in later chapters, written documents thereby provided precedents and models that would eventually be used by computers. The ability of computers to create intersubjective realities is an extension of the power of clay tablets and pieces of paper. As a key example, consider ownership. In oral communities that lacked written documents, ownership was an intersubjective reality created through the words and behaviors of the community members. To own a field meant that your neighbors agreed that this field was yours, and they behaved accordingly. They didn't build a hut on that field, graze their livestock there, or pick fruits there without first asking your permission. Ownership was created and maintained by people continuously saying or signaling things to one another. This made ownership the affair of a local community and placed a limit on the ability of a distant central authority to control all land ownership. No king, minister, or priest could remember who owned each field in hundreds of distant villages. This also placed a limit on the ability of individuals to claim and exercise absolute property rights, and instead favored various forms of communal property rights. For example, your neighbors might acknowledge your right to cultivate a field, but not your right to sell it to foreigners. In a literate state, to own a field increasingly came to mean that it is written on some clay tablet, bamboo strip, piece of paper, or silicon chip that you own that field. If your neighbors have been grazing their sheep for years on a piece of land and none of them ever said that you own it, but you can somehow produce an official document that says it is yours, you have a good chance of enforcing your claim. Conversely, If all the neighbours agree that it is your field, but you don't have any official document that proves it, tough luck. Ownership is still an intersubjective reality created by exchanging information, but the information now takes the form of a written document or a computer file, rather than of people talking and gesturing to each other. This means that ownership can now be determined by a central authority that produces and holds the relevant documents. It also means that you can sell your field without asking your neighbor's permission, simply by transferring the crucial document to someone else. The power of documents to create intersubjective realities was beautifully manifested in the old Assyrian dialect, which treated documents as living things that could also be killed. Loan contracts were killed, duecum, when the debt was repaid. This was done by destroying the tablet, adding some mark to it, or breaking its seal. The loan contract didn't represent reality, it was the reality. If somebody repaid the loan but failed to kill the document, the debt was still owed. Conversely, if somebody didn't repay the loan but the document died in some other way, perhaps the dog ate it, the debt was no more. The same happens with money. If your dog eats a $100 bill, those $100 cease to exist. In Shulgi's Ur in ancient Assyria, and in numerous subsequent polities, social, economic, and political relations relied on documents that create reality instead of merely representing it. When writing constitutions, peace treaties, and commercial contracts, lawyers, politicians, and business people wrangle for weeks and even months over each word because they know that these pieces of paper can wield enormous power. Bureaucracy. Every new information technology has its unexpected bottlenecks. It solves some old problems, but creates new ones. In the early 1730s BCE, Naramtani, a priestess in the Mesopotamian city of Sippar, wrote a letter on a clay tablet to a relative, asking him to send her a few clay tablets he kept in his house. She explained that her claim to an inheritance was being contested and she couldn't prove her case in court without those documents. She ended her message with a plea, "Now, do not neglect me." We don't know what happened next, but just imagine the situation if the relative searched his house but could not find the missing tablets. As people produced more and more documents, finding them turned out to be far from easy. This was a particular challenge for kings, priests, merchants, and anyone else who accumulated thousands of documents in their archives. How do you find the right tax record, payment receipt, or business contract when you need it? Written documents were much better than human brains in recording certain types of information, but they created a new and very thorny problem: retrieval. The brain is remarkably efficient in retrieving whatever information is stored in its network of tens of billions of neurons and trillions of synapses. Though our brain archives countless complex stories about our personal life, our national history, and our religious mythology, healthy people can retrieve information about any of them in less than a second. What did you eat for breakfast? Who was your first crush? When did your country gain its independence? What's the first verse in the Bible? How did you retrieve all these pieces of information? What mechanism activates the right neurons and synapses to rapidly call up the necessary information? Though neuroscientists have made some progress in the study of memory, nobody yet understands what memories are or how exactly they are stored and retrieved. What we do know is that millions of years of evolution streamlined the brain's retrieval processes. However, once humans have outsourced memories from organic brains to inorganic documents, retrieval could no longer rely on that streamlined biological system. Nor could it rely on the foraging abilities that humans evolved over millions of years. Evolution has adapted humans for finding fruits and mushrooms in a forest, but not for finding documents in an archive. Foragers locate fruits and mushrooms in a forest because evolution has organized forests according to a discernible organic order. Fruit trees photosynthesize, so they require sunlight. Mushrooms feed on dead organic matter, which can usually be found in the ground. So mushrooms are usually down at soil level, whereas fruits grow farther up. Another common rule is that apples grow on apple trees, whereas figs grow on fig trees. So if you're looking for an apple, you first need to locate an apple tree, and then look up. When living in a forest, humans learn this organic order. It is very different with archives. Since documents aren't organisms, they don't obey any biological laws, and evolution didn't organize them for us. Tax reports don't grow on a tax report shelf. They need to be placed there. For that, somebody first needs to come up with the idea of categorizing information by shelves, and to decide which documents should go on which shelf. Unlike foragers, who need merely to discover the pre-existing order of the forest, archivists need to devise a new order for the world. That order is called bureaucracy. Bureaucracy is the way people in large organizations solved the retrieval problem and thereby created bigger and more powerful information networks. But like mythology, bureaucracy too tends to sacrifice truth for order. By inventing a new order and imposing it on the world, bureaucracy distorted people's understanding of the world in unique ways. Many of the problems of our 21st century information networks, like biased algorithms that mislabel people, or rigid protocols that ignore human needs and feelings, are not new problems of the computer age. They are quintessential bureaucratic problems that have existed long before anyone even dreamed of computers. Bureaucracy and the search for truth. Bureaucracy literally means rule by writing desk. The term was invented in 18th century France, when the typical official sat next to a writing desk with drawers, a bureau. At the heart of the bureaucratic order, then, is the drawer. Bureaucracy seeks to solve the retrieval problem by dividing the world into drawers, and knowing which document goes into which drawer. The principle remains the same regardless of whether the document is placed into a drawer, a shelf, a basket, a jar, a computer folder, or any other receptacle. Divide and rule. Divide the world into containers, and keep the containers separate so the documents don't get mixed up. This principle, however, comes with a price. Instead of focusing on understanding the world as it is, bureaucracy is often busy imposing a new and artificial order on the world. Bureaucrats begin by inventing various drawers, which are intersubjective realities that don't necessarily correspond to any objective divisions in the world. The bureaucrats then try to force the world to fit into these drawers, and if the fit isn't very good, the bureaucrats push harder. Anyone who ever filled out an official form knows this only too well. When you fill out the form and none of the listed options fits your circumstances, you must adapt yourself to the form rather than the form adapting to you. Reducing the messiness of reality to a limited number of fixed drawers helps bureaucrats keep order, but it comes at the expense of truth. Because they are fixated on their drawers, even when reality is far more complex, bureaucrats often develop a distorted understanding of the world. The urge to divide reality into rigid drawers also leads bureaucrats to pursue narrow goals irrespective of the wider impact of their actions. A bureaucrat tasked with increasing industrial production is likely to ignore environmental considerations that fall outside her purview, and perhaps dump toxic waste into a nearby river, leading to an ecological disaster downstream. If the government then establishes a new department to combat pollution, its bureaucrats are likely to push for ever more stringent regulations, even if this results in economic ruin for communities upstream. Ideally, someone should be able to take into account all the different considerations and aspects, But such a holistic approach requires transcending or abolishing the bureaucratic division. The distortions created by bureaucracy affect not only government agencies and private corporations, but also scientific disciplines.